We can't really talk about quiet and silence without talking about its opposite, noise. Garrett Kaiser is the author of The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. Kaiser tells Steve Paulson, it's hard to come up with a precise definition of noise. It's not just unwanted sound.
Like all definitions, it only goes so far. It's a definition that really grew out of electronic technology, engineers distinguishing signal from noise, noise being unwanted sound. I prefer to think of noise as any sound that interferes with the full exercise and enjoyment of life. And I won't just say human life, since noise also affects the lives of animals. Noise also affects other sounds. It's a commonplace to make a binary out of noise and silence, and then also to assign values, and noise stands for wickedness and silence stands for good. I have difficulty with that for a number of reasons, and I prefer to think of noise not as the enemy of silence, but as the enemy of a whole lot of other sounds that I enjoy, that most of us enjoy, and that I think are essential to a full human life, such as conversation. Our human voices evolved at a decibel level in a world that did not contain jackhammers and supersonic jets and could usually be counted on to be heard over just about anything but an erupting volcano. That's no longer the case.
And I think a lot of us, if you were to ask us, so what is noise? You know, we could rattle off a bunch of things, loud planes, highway traffic noise, music blaring loudly, jackhammers. Are there other kinds of noise that might go under the radar that are just as insidious, but that we tend not to think about?
Well, context is going to determine a lot of what you regard as noise. And another thing that interested me about the subject is that, like human beings themselves, noise has, you know, a subjective and an objective component. You can measure sound, but what makes a sound a noise has a certain subjective quality to it. You might not consider the sound of your blender to be a noise because it's your blender and you're making your drink with it, but perhaps the stereo system coming from the house across the way you would regard as noise. So context determines, and a number of subjective factors will determine what we regard as a noise.
Coming back to this notion then of whether it's wanted or not. So one person's music, which gives that person joy, might really bother someone else.
Yes, it might. And that needs to be acknowledged. At the same time, the disingenuousness of claiming that that subjectivity therefore renders the whole issue of noise pollution and noise annoyance moot also needs to be acknowledged, so that someone says, well, it may be noise to you, but it's music to me, and vice versa. Well, that depends on some other factors, such as a community's reasonable expectations of being able to sleep at night and factors like that.
So partly what you're talking about is noise intrudes on our personal space, our sense of solitude, our sense of well-being.
Yes, and each of us is usually pretty good at recognizing that when we're on the receiving end, we are less good, and I'm including myself in we, in recognizing how some of our activities may affect others. The passenger in business class who's sitting in the plane and it's quiet and it's nice and there's a drink on the arm of the chair and his iPad is open and he's quietly doing some work before his next big meeting, doesn't hear the noise of the little shoebox house that's near the airport because that's the only place where the real estate's affordable for the person who lives there and who lives with that sound every single day. So I think when we explore noise annoyance, if we don't get beyond our own particular annoyance at specific sounds that we single out, we can become very close to cranks and nothing more. A thoroughgoing exploration of noise includes recognizing our effects on others and how our excesses sometimes affect people who barely have minimum.
Well, and you're also suggesting there are always power relationships involved here, and one quality of having social status or economic status is you can insulate yourself from other people's noise, and those who are powerless can't. I mean, they tend to live in very noisy environments.
That's right, and that's been demonstrated by surveys and censuses. But historically, yes, power confers the privilege of being able to make noise, but it also confers the ability to silence other people's sounds, which are regarded as noise. In the Middle Ages, there was an ordinance in one city requiring that all services coming from synagogues be said in a low voice so as not to disturb the sensibilities of Christian neighbors. And that's a majority deciding what's noise, and noise, as is often the case in history, is whatever issues from the mouths or the instruments of a minority.
So how does this play out in our society today? How powerless people tend to be subjected to noise?
Well, they're subjected to noise in any number of ways. They're subjected to it because their residences are often located in noisy places and noisy parts of the city, next to noisy transportation sources. I think the leading source of noise in the world is transportation, and so you have people who are located next to airports, they're located next to highways, so noise plays out in that way. You know, noise affects one's ability to sleep. But also, I think the poor and the marginal are often affected indirectly by some assumptions we have about noise. So we make up this mythology that if you're poor or you're a member of a certain ethnic group, you sort of like noise. You know, them people don't need to sleep the way us people do.
Now, one of the chapters in your book is called Loud America. And there is this perception that we in America are especially loud. And I guess I'm curious whether that's true. I mean, are Americans noisier than people from other countries?
Well, I don't know if that is so, only because I have traveled, but I don't think I've traveled extensively enough to make a blanket statement. But we are a prosperous nation relative to other nations. And with prosperity, there does come the means for making noise, not only the literal noise, the acoustic noise that comes from aircraft, that comes from military weapons, but also the noise that comes with power, the ability of a dominant culture to drown out the low decibel strains of other people's cultures, languages, music, etc.
And of course, this is again where money comes into play. You know, if you're rich enough, it's easier for you to buy some quiet.
That's right. Silence and quietness are forms of wealth. And like other forms of wealth, they are not distributed equally or justly, in my opinion.
So given all this research that you did, I mean, looking into noise from all kinds of different dimensions, including the social and political dimensions, and recognizing that this is a bigger problem than most of us realize, what can we do about it? How should we think about noise in a different way?
Well, there are a number of things I think that we can do about it. First of all, we can recognize that it is a problem, that it is a health problem, and that, like other health problems, it affects people disproportionately. Second of all, I think we can become a little less sheep-like. We like to associate in America noise with being rebellious, you know, with being some kind of a Marlon Brando. So we make a lot of noise on the weekends, and then we sort of go back to the chain gang Monday through Friday and watch our health insurance taken away. I think one of the things that we can cultivate is a healthy, neighborly, reasonable resistance to those things that are destroying our quality of life. And we can make that good kind of noise, which is protest. And then a third thing I think we can do, and I don't think it can be emphasized enough, although it sounds somewhat glib rolling off the tongue, is we can build stronger communities and get to know our neighbors better. A neighborhood in the deepest and the best sense is a very effective weapon against noise in a couple of ways, if you'll bear with me. First of all, If you know your neighbor, you're going to be more mindful of your own noise. You're also probably going to be a little bit more tolerant of his noise. The example I like to use is there's a young man who lives down the road from me who has a pretty loud truck, as young men sometimes do. And the sound of that truck, which he does not drive back and forth 100 times a day in front of my house, but the sound of that truck doesn't come to my ears as noise. It comes to my ears as the sound of a young man who, when I had pneumonia one winter, came by and plowed out my driveway faithfully because I could barely lean on a shovel. So that sound means to me that he's young and having a good time, and that's the way he likes to do it. And I also noticed that because he knows me, he doesn't rev it up when he goes by my house. He waits till he's down the road a little bit, and then he revs it up. The other thing, though, that knowing one's neighbors can do is when a noise source threatens a community that's larger than any device within that community, a large transportation source, a large industrial source, a large military source. And when these sorts of things get developed near communities, those pushing them through know very easily how to divide and conquer, how to enlist the resentment that's in the community against neighbors in order to make it easier to railroad these things through. A strong community, a community that has lived together, of people who've lived together with something like kindness, when they close ranks, they can resist forces many times themselves and sometimes successfully.
Gerrit Kaiser is the author of The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. He spoke with Steve Paulson.